Well, the clock on the wall says it's time for Spectrum West. Good to be with you. I'm Al Ross. This is where people come to talk and listen about and to the arts, music, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin. Today, author Nicholas Butler is back, returning to chat and revisiting the literary world with Beneath the Bonfire, the follow-up to his wildly successful Shotgun Love Songs. He grew up in Eau Claire, still lives in our midst. Jim Oliver welcomes Wayne Merrick for a look at Cabaret from the Eau Claire Children's Theater. We'll meet Jessica Mojan. Her art is on display at the Local Store Gallery, the Volume 1 headquarters in downtown Eau Claire. She's an art lecturer at UW-Barron County in Rice Lake. And here comes our first conversation. When one gets to this time of year, one is amazed how quickly the seasons or the series of concerts presented by so many fine artistic organizations in West Wisconsin, how quickly they go by. Until we find ourselves facing the last event of that season. We face just such an event Saturday evening as the 40th season for the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra comes to an end. It's called Titans of Spring, and Executive Director Tony Zammit accepted my invitation to stop by for a look at what's coming. I've always liked spring. I just don't know that I've ever used the word Titans when I talk about spring. So tell me about the title, Titans of Spring, this Saturday's concert.
Just a little bit of fun play with words, Al. Gustav Mahler's symphony Titan will be featured. It's actually funny when looking back at the history of that symphony. He only called it Titan twice. Anytime he built it after a certain year, he never built it that way, but it's now come down in posterity as Titan.
Really?
And we all feature it that way, yeah.
It's literally Symphony Number 1.
Correct.
But it all starts, Saturday's concert, with a number called Blue Cathedral, and something we don't hear a lot of and from are female composers. And I understand this Jennifer Higdon is a 50-something American composer. It's an interesting fantasy, I hear.
It's interesting on multiple levels. First off, you have a female composer who's not only American and living for a symphonic piece is always a neat thing to kind of have. But what makes this one really special is the percussion in this. There's some oddities there that definitely the first time we as a symphony have ever had to order 25 sets of Chinese medicine balls. Yeah, that little tingling noise that is a part of this one, as well as wine glasses, which gives it kind of a haunting feel at times.
Ooh.
So it's a neat piece. I would encourage people to come down. It'll be something that you won't have heard anything like this in the past at one of our shows.
Is this the wine glasses, not playing it with a little mallet, but this is the
this
rubbing
is the,
of the tip?
The rubbing the wine glasses, which of course gives you that kind of haunting tone.
Oh. Your percussionists all do this?
Our percussionists do this, and with the medicine balls, some of the members of the symphony will be playing those that are not percussionists. So it's kind of a neat little effect that you get, and we were fortunate that Susan Halderman, our principal cellist, had suggested the piece, and we're very excited about playing it.
I have a pair of those Chinese medicine deals. You have to flip them over in your hand because it incorporates and exercises all the muscles in one hand plus your forearm. Is that how they're going to play them, or are they just going to shake?
No, you have to kind of spin them around to get the right sound.
Yeah.
Again, Blue Cathedral, it kind of mimics the sound of church bells, especially when you have that many of them going. But not as spot on the nose as if we were just to ring big bells.
Are those things called for in the composition?
Yes. When you perform the piece, you have to basically agree that you're going to use this. You can't leave it out. The composer is very, very strict about how she wants this piece performed. And when you hear it, you can understand why, because, again, it's very, very unique.
Blue Cathedral, that's called. Are we familiar? What do we know about her?
She's an American composer, and she has composed a lot of more modern music and some more modern church music. Not a lot of...
Any soundtracks or anything?
Not that I know of.
Okay. The Mahler piece was written a lot longer ago, between 1887 and 1888. Four movements, and they're all pretty different as they interpret different travels and varied sentiments, I read. Mahler is always perceived as a challenge. Is this one of those?
This is one of those big challenge pieces again. And this is one of those pieces that, just talking about it, with the symphony members and with various folks from the music department at the university, this is one of those pieces other folks really respect and want to come out to see that are in classical music. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of like saying you're going to jump the Grand Canyon on a motorcycle. Everyone wants to come out and see you try it.
Yeah.
Because it's a big, powerful piece, especially that last movement. As Nobu said, it may be the most powerful finale of a piece that we do.
I was reading about Mahler, too, and his first and second symphonies have some sort of significance, maybe just the fact that they were first and second.
With this one, this is kind of a unique symphony because it had started out as several different pieces, and Mahler pieced it together a little bit, I wouldn't say later in his career, but mid-career. And as I said, we call it Titan. And he titled that for two of his performances of it. But at a certain point, he himself stopped calling it that. But it's a piece that you can kind of, if you look at the various movements, as you said, they're all a little bit different. Mm-hmm. You can tell it was someone in his career that kind of, it reflects different parts of his career, if you will, that they've come together at a certain point.
Well, they might even be described as a lot different.
Yeah.
Because one is kind of a funeral dirge and one is maybe a little happier. I don't know. So that's cool. Tony Zammit with us in the studio, Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. He's the executive director. The concert is called Titans of Spring. It's Saturday, 7:30 p.m., Gantner Concert Hall, UW-Eau Claire. This is the final concert, Tony, of the 40th season. How's the season gone? Has it been an impressive season?
It's been a fantastic season. We're very excited. We've seen some increases in our attendance numbers.
Cool.
And brought in a lot of new folks that experience the symphony for the first time. We're hoping to continue that. It's a great way to see great music here in the local community. And if you haven't been, I encourage you to come. Come as you are. Don't feel that you need to put on a suit and tie and dress up to come. We'd love to have you right off the street. But come and see amazing talent here in the area play some of the greatest music ever written.
I've always told people that you just should come once and you'll be back.
Yep. That's absolutely right.
And there's no excuse for not going that first time. Bring the family. It's fun stuff. Your stint as executive director, you're getting to be in the veteran stage now. How's that going?
I am. It's been fantastic. We've been very fortunate this year, as I said. We've been up attendance-wise, and working with Nobu is always a joy. And I think right now he's in a very creative phase, and moving into next year, we've got some great ideas for our concerts, and mm-hmm. I think we're only going to get stronger.
Has it lived up to what you envisioned of it, or has it turned out to be even more satisfying and maybe even fun?
I think it's even more satisfying and fun. I think that when you come into any position, there's kind of a learning curve to it.
Sure.
And a lot of when we sat down, actually, if you remember, it was the first day on the job I sat down with you last year.
Yes, I do.
If you would have asked me what I would have accomplished over that year, it would have been very different than the things we did accomplish. Whenever you move into a position, obviously, you find greater areas of need than you thought they might be. But mm-hmm. I think we're at the point now where we've got things running really smoothly. And I think next year is going to be a really triumphant season for us.
With the symphony, you have a lot of great people to work with. I mean, people who do a lot of pulling and pushing of things.
We've got great people within the office and board members. But the big thing, I think, is really giving our tremendous talent in the form of the symphony and Nobu the chance to succeed. The best thing I can do is, as executive director, is set up a good framework that they can work within and then just stay out of the way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because people, I don't think, realize the level of talent that we have in this town when it comes to symphonic music.
I can attest to that. This is also kind of the swan song for some young people who have been members of the orchestra. They are graduating and moving on, university students.
Yep. With our symphony, we usually have about 40% of them are people who are a little bit older who live in the area.
Yep.
Another, I would say, 3rd to 25% are folks that come in from out of town. But then we have a third of them that are university students, and I think they bring great passion to our organization.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, at the end of 4 years, we see a lot of those folks move on. We are fortunate with all that's going on in Eau Claire the past couple of years economically. We are holding on to more of those people, and I think the fact that they have the opportunity to play in our symphony is one thing that might be keeping some of those folks here.
A 41st season isn't always as exciting as a 40th because that's a milestone. So you work hard to make the 41st special, and you're doing that now.
Well, I think you can't overlook any season. I think we're kind of hitting on some great ideas for concerts next year. And for example, we're looking at next October, we're going to be at Gantner Hall, and we're going to be doing, I don't want to say a Halloween theme concert, mm-hmm. but we're going to take some of the great macabre music that's out there, symphonic music, and put that together in a show. Next Christmas, we're looking at, again, bringing back Anna Johnson from Chippewa Falls, who was with us last year and put on a phenomenal show.
Okay.
We're hoping that if that's successful again this year, we might make that an annual occurrence. Next February, we're going to be bringing in some of the great German composers.
Right.
So you're going to get the classics. And then next March, we're very excited. We're going to be doing a history of music concert that's going to walk people through the entire history of symphony, even before symphony, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll wrap it all up a year from now with Bruckner,
wow.
which is Nobu's favorite. So.
Yes. He's, you know, you got to appease the guy. You got to play some of his favorites.
Like I said, my job is just to make sure he has the resources and then get out of his way. He's a dynamo. We're very lucky to have him.
Tony Zammit, good guy, surrounded by good people. It's the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. They have a concert Saturday night, Gantner Concert Hall, UW-Eau Claire. Be there if you can. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you very much, Al.
And, of course, the website is cvsymphony.com. .org. Is it .org? I have .dot here. I'm going to check that out. I'm going to make sure of that, and I'll let you know for sure later. Hey, did you know that support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, presenting the surreal work of Madison artist Stephen Hilliard in Seeking the Sublime, on exhibit through July 15th. Visit and support information at mmam.org. Now, Mr. Hilliard's name is spelled S-T-E-P-H-E-N. If it's Stefan, eesh. Sorry, at least I got it in. Well, guess what? It's time again for a musical production from the Eau Claire Children's Theater, and Jim Oliver is all over that.
The musical Cabaret is based on a 1939 novel by Christopher Isherwood and a 1951 play by John Van Druten. The musical opened in New York in 1966 and features music by John Kander and lyrics by Fred Ebb. The Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Cabaret plays this weekend at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Coming back to talk to us about Cabaret and all the other stuff going on at the Children's Theater this summer is Wayne Merrick, founder and executive director of the Children's Theater and director of Cabaret. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Set in the period between two world wars in Germany, the play has some historic aspects, doesn't it?
It is certainly is set in the or on the eve, say, of the rise of Nazism in Germany. And that is, of course, a large theme throughout the show.
You want to talk about what the show is about?
Well, basically, it's set in a cabaret, the Kit Kat Club.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of two storylines going along during the show. You have the characters, Cliff and Sally, Frau Schneider and Herr Schultz, going through their situations. Relationships are being developed, things like that. But on the other hand, there is the Kit Kat Club and the numbers that are performed at the Kit Kat Club comment on the situations that they're going through. The threat of Nazism goes throughout the show. The different things that society is experiencing at that time goes throughout the show. So you have the kind of the dichotomy of the characters and what they're going through commented on by the performers at the Kit Kat Club. So it's a very interesting juxtaposition because on the one hand, it's musical theater. So you have these musical numbers and things like that. But they all have a little bit more depth to them, a little more meaning. Like I said, they comment on the action in the show. So it's not your typical show tunes kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them actually are maybe a little bit darker, and the numbers reflect back. The MC and the numbers reflect on what's going on in the show.
Now, it has one set in the Kit Kat Club, or is there another scene somewhere?
Actually, for this production that we're doing is the 1998 revival version, so it's the newest of the three different versions out there, meant to be staged very minimally, I guess, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The orchestra is on stage. It's a two-story set. So the orchestra kind of rings the stage up on top. The action takes place down below. There's really a minimal set with three doors that represent the different locations. There's a set of, you know, six chairs that are used throughout to represent the club and the train and, you know, his apartment and things like that. Mm-hmm. So very minimal. So the audience shouldn't expect to see, you know, what you might think of as a tawdry black and red CD nightclub. In that sense, it's meant to be more suggested, more minimal, with the focus being on the storyline and the characters rather than the spectacle of a big flashy set.
Now, it's billed as having mature themes. So if I have kids to go to the theater, how old should they be?
Sure. We are advertising it as PG-13, mm-hmm. mainly for the themes of the show. Mm-hmm. Strangely or not, it's not the language, but it would be the themes that are involved in the show that would warrant maybe some discussion. And actually, that is one reason why we do these types of shows, is maybe to generate some discussion between families. But there are, you know, themes of questioning your sexuality, unwanted pregnancies, interfaith marriages, things like that that you know, might warrant some discussion and might be a little bit over the heads of younger audience members.
Mm-hmm. He is Wayne Merrick, who is director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Cabaret. Who are some of the principal actors?
The lead, the MC, is Eric Vandenhoevel, who was just on stage with us as the Cat in the Hat. So you can imagine this playing the cat in the Cat in the Hat and then playing the MC in Cabaret are two vastly different roles. Sally Bowles is Carrie Baggs, who, when she was in Eau Claire, not married, was Carrie Herman and did some shows with us and performed locally, got married, moved away, and just happened to be back for a while this spring and summer and has the lead in the show. And then she'll be in the next couple of productions with us as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there a familiar music? Cabaret, I guess, was the one.
I think a lot. I mean, yeah. A lot of people know Cabaret. Mm-hmm. Maybe This Time, The Money Song. There are a number of songs from the movie version that I think are fairly iconic or associated with Liza Minnelli, for example, mm-hmm, sure. That people would know. The 98 Revival has the same storyline, of course, in all the versions, but the musical order is a little bit different. They included as many of the movie songs as possible that aren't necessarily in some of the other revival versions.
Looking at the Children's Theater webpage, there's a ton of things going on this spring, the rest of this spring, and
right.
This summer. Let's talk about the fifth annual talent competition.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that is for young people, whereas we're talking about Cabaret, it is an all-adult cast. Mm-hmm. So if anybody's confused about, okay. You know, if we should bring kids or not, you know, high school and up, and it is an adult cast. But the talent show is actually for ages 2 to 18. There's two categories, a youth and a teen category. Mm-hmm. This will be the fifth year that we've been running it in conjunction with the Northern Wisconsin State Fair. And actually just last year, and now again this year, they've started a statewide competition at the State Fair in August out in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Now the winners from the local contest in Chippewa at the Northern Wisconsin State Fair move on to the state competition. And for any performers out there, it's variety acts, music, dance, you know, singing, whatever. You win prize money at the local level, but there's up to $3,000 in prize money at the state level. So it's worth it if you want to mm-hmm. go through the competition part of it. There's no fee to enter. Mm-hmm. So really, there's no reason not to do it.
Also, you have summer theater classes.
Correct. Deadline is the end of May to register for those. There's over 50 classes for ages 3 to 18. Pretty much anything you can think of with acting and makeup and combat, and I kind of think of all of them, tech theater. There's a lot of performance classes. Those tend to be the most popular ones, the ones that are maybe a week or 2 weeks long and they end in a performance. Mm-hmm. Those tend to fill up first. But there's lots of different things for people with experience, no experience. It's really the way that many young people get their first taste of theater, and then they start auditioning, and then we kind of see them keep coming back for classes and shows. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to get your feet wet and see, you know, oh, I like the singing, but I didn't really like the dancing, or mm-hmm. boy, I'd like to be an actor, or I don't ever want to act, but I really thought, you know, lighting was cool or things like that. So it's a good way to get your feet wet.
I always kind of wondered how you get enough people to come and audition for all the shows that you do. That sounds like one of the keys. Right?
Get that interest going when they're young, either coming to see shows through school matinees or our public shows, taking classes, you know, coming with their Girl Scout troop, any of those options, you know, to get them exposed to theater and go, hey, I really like that, and that's something I could do either on stage or backstage.
Sure. Well, let's get back to the theater in general. What are some of the shows coming up this summer?
Right. We've actually got still some shows left this season that are our full productions coming up in beginning of June. We're doing Carousel in Concert, which is our first time doing a concert version of a show. I think lots of people know Carousel because it's a classic Rodgers and Hammerstein. But this is a concert version, which means the script is a little bit reduced. So the script part of it is shorter, but all of the music is in the show. The orchestra is on stage. It is fully staged. There's costumes, that kind of thing. I think people maybe have seen concert versions, the Kennedy Center or Carnegie Hall concert versions of some musicals. So this will be an interesting, take on the show where the orchestra is right there and just kind of a different experience for us. 110 in the Shade is coming up later in June. That's a Schmidt and Jones musical. Most people probably are familiar with them from The Fantastics or I Do, which has run in the area for years. Mm. So that's another small musical at the Oxford. We're doing a dinner theater this summer, which is a little different, and that's in July for The 39 Steps, which is based on an Alfred Hitchcock movie. And so it's kind of a film noir, not a murder mystery, but a film noir type of show. With four characters playing over 150 characters. So that'll be a challenge for the four actors to pull that off. But we're doing that one as a dinner theater. And then the end of the season is West Side Story, which is our big big summer musical. Once again, a classic that hasn't been done in the area for a while.
Mm-hmm. So I assume then you're probably starting to plan already for the next season?
We are planning. I think it's pretty much set. Usually the season brochure goes out in July, and it's always ready by – it'll be ready by West Side Story. So. Oh. We'll keep you guessing until then.
Oh, shucks. I thought maybe I could break some news here for a change. Well, we've been talking to Wayne Merrick, who is director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Cabaret. The show runs through Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. You can order tickets online at the Children's Theater website at www.ecct.org. Wayne Merrick, thanks so much for coming back and talking to
Thank
us.
Thank you.
And thanks, Jim, as always. Here's a Spectrum memo. Go paint. A plein air painting event comes to the Durand, Wisconsin area next week, beginning Sunday with a popular quick paint, the Old Courthouse Museum at 2 p.m. Lots more during the week. Info online at imaginationnation.org. Imaginationnation.org. I'm Al Ross. This is Spectrum West. Good to have you along this week and every week. One of the delights of residing in West Wisconsin is the attention many venues have given to art, fine art, visual art. It was a stroke of luck for all of us when the fine folks at Volume 1 decided to include a gallery when moving to new headquarters on Dewey Street in Eau Claire, turning the first floor into the local gallery and the local store and gallery. Today, when you head for that gallery, you'll find the work of Jessica Mojan, an art lecturer at UW-Barron County in Rice Lake. Raised in North Dakota and coming to Wisconsin by way of Montana and elsewhere, Mojan's art is vibrant, colorful, interesting, exciting. Through acrylic painting, she explores geography and natural organisms, allowing chaos and spontaneity to play a role. I talked the other day with Jessica about her art and the current Eau Claire exhibit. So, interestingly enough, you know, whereas the guy said, go west, young man, yours was go east, young lady. North Dakota, Montana, and now Wisconsin. I noted that you're going to observe your one-year anniversary at UW-Barron County sometime this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Were you just a working artist prior to that, or were you an educator? And if so, have you found a nice niche in Rice Lake?
Well, for a while, I was a full-time working artist, and then I was a part-time working artist. And, yeah, I really enjoy Rice Lake. It's a beautiful place to live. In the winter, you can ski. I actually did volunteer ski lessons at Christie Mountain in the Blue Hills.
Cool.
That was really nice.
Let's talk a bit about, since we've alluded to it already, growing up in North Dakota and young Jessica's love of art. Were you one of those kids who put a lot of crayon stuff on the fridge? Was there early interest in art?
Yes, I was definitely interested in art when I was younger. I think even from the age of before kindergarten, but my mom said when I was about kindergarten age, I would draw something. I think I was usually trying to draw horses, and it wouldn't look right, so I'd crumple it up and throw it on the ground and try again. And
well, how did that blossom? You just took some art courses then in junior high and high school and then said, wow, this is me.
I always wanted to be an artist. I actually wanted to be an author illustrator. I think that's what I said when I was in first grade, although I think I said a book writer and drawer. I had a really good art teacher. We had the same art teacher throughout elementary school, junior high, and high school, and I took some private art lessons. Yeah, I've just always been interested in it.
Still time for the, you know, the book illustrator.
Yeah, well, you know, who knows when that'll happen.
Now, I noticed in addition to standard courses like drawing and other artistic methods, you also have taught or do lecture on a thing called Women in the Arts. Talk about that a bit.
Yes, well, that is basically an art history class that focuses on the history and, I guess, current women in the arts. And a lot of times in art history classes, it really focuses on artwork made by men, especially the more Renaissance artwork and older artwork. And this course really approaches art history in a different way, specifically studying female artists.
Uh-huh. Are there marked differences?
Well, I think that the difference is that female artists tend to be underrecognized, even now in New York art galleries and museums, there are more male artists being shown. That doesn't mean that there are more male artists necessarily. It's just that for some reason they're still taken more seriously a lot of the time. I think it's gotten a lot better since the 60s and 70s when women kind of fought to be recognized for what they were doing, but I think there is still some discrepancy there.
I mean, years and years ago, it was almost a novelty for female artists to be out there. I remember Grandma Moses getting discovered, and everybody said, oh, isn't that cute?
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to realize that women artists are just as valid and are making artwork that is contemporary and important. And then even going back and looking at some of the artists, like Artemisia Gentileschi from the Renaissance, doing artwork that's, you know, it's just as good as Leonardo da Vinci, but people might not have known about it as much. And she's one of the few that were actually recognized, and she did make money from her art.
Yeah. On the phone with Jessica Mojan, she's a lecturer in art at UW-Barron County in Rice Lake. Her current exhibit in our neighborhood is at the Volume 1 Gallery in downtown Eau Claire. It's up through June 27th. In examining your website, Jessica, which is jessicamojan.com, and reading blogs, it's pretty easy to see that art is a part of your day. In fact, last year you did a drawing a day.
A lot of people have been doing drawing a day projects and putting them online, putting them on Instagram.
Ah, okay.
One of my friends from graduate school did a drawing a day project, actually. So I got the idea from that, and I wanted to try it.
Let's talk about technique for a minute. So much of your daily routine, the thing we just alluded to, the drawing a day thing, is the realism type stuff. Most of what you exhibit is not, although it begins, the exhibited art anyway, many times with digital photos. In some, there are recognizable figures, naturalist things. In fact, you describe your work with words like disorder, controlled chaos, contortion, tension. Few of your paintings are called entropy. Is there a one and a two, maybe even more than that? And for those of you who are rushing to the dictionary, I can help you out before you get there. Entropy is lack of order or predictability, gradual decline into disorder. Wow. How did that all begin for you?
Well, I've always been interested in integrating nature and art and using nature as kind of a starting point and then changing it. So I think thinking about change in nature and chaos and how all of these processes happen and, you know, they become something and, you know, it seems like they're chaotic, but everything in nature happens for a reason. So this plant is interacting with this other plant or, geology. I've studied a lot of geology, kind of environmental readings, how humans interact with nature.
You employ something called fractals, otherwise simplified to mean a never-ending pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on fractals and how the incorporation of that became part of what you do?
Well, I think that's one of the underlying themes, thinking about how things that you see that are large connect to things that are really small. So if you look at a shoreline, it's actually made out of fractal patterns that are the same that you would see if you look at something under a microscope. So these little shapes are repeating and repeating and creating all of these organic forms that are in the world. I like to highlight that and really change the scale between objects, and mm-hmm. that does connect back to that fractal geometry.
Okay. So you talked about a lot of your art having to do with nature. Describe your process, if you would please, of beginning a project. Does it start from an idea, or is an idea born as you go? What's your process?
Well, the place that I live informs my art quite a bit, or places that I travel. So my artwork that I've made in Wisconsin looks a lot different than the artwork that I made in Montana or North Dakota. And since I moved to Wisconsin, I've really focused more on plant life and fungi and tiny things that are in the woods. I don't have as many large vistas as in Montana, so I've really focused on the small scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with the photos that I took and found the ones that stood out to me, and then used those as a starting point to begin a painting.
Ah. I've always been curious about the size of a work for some reason. Some of your pieces, if you look at exhibits, are smaller, in the 16 by 20 category. They do get bigger, maybe 24 by 48. There are some two-panel murals measuring, nearly 6 feet in width and even larger. How and when is it determined how large a piece will be?
A lot of it depends on the process that I'm using. So the process I'm using now does lend itself well to smaller paintings, but okay. The reason I developed that process is because I wanted to work smaller. When I was in Montana, I worked very large on 5 by 6 foot paper paintings. And I used really big brushes, and they were huge. But then when I came to Wisconsin and when I was in North Dakota after grad school, mm-hmm. and I had some artist residencies, so I was moving around a lot, I didn't have enough space for these huge paintings. So I decided to work on these smaller panels, and I changed my process. So I started using the photo transfers, which work really well small because they have a lot of detail. Yeah, I think it works well with the subject matter I'm using now, too, with the fungi and plants, because they are very small. So even when I show them in these smaller paintings, they're still larger than life.
Your paintings, and this is an interpretation on my part, seem to have an almost biological facet to them. And that probably fits now that I know that you've talked about the natural side of things. It's almost as if your mind is capturing natural processes in progress. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think so. I'm thinking about breaking down of matter. So a lot of the fungi, they're breaking down old wood and mm-hmm. returning it to the soil, and it's creating this process. So I'm capturing it in a moment and then using color to kind of make it seem like it's more dramatic or faster and exciting. Because if you just come across an old mushroom in the forest, you might not think it's that great, but mm-hmm. maybe if I can highlight it and show it a different way, you'll pay attention to it.
I'm trying to put myself in the place of a listener now. I'm wondering if they're sitting back saying, does this girl paint mushrooms and fungus, or what does she paint? And I want people to understand that your paintings are very, very interesting. They're very colorful. They're very playful in many cases. I don't know if those are the right terms a critic would use. I noticed on your website, because you have links that go 2015, 14, 13, 12, there has been an evolution of your paintings. It feels as if you've blossomed. You've used a lot more color in things. Is that because of where you lived, or what happened there?
Well, I definitely have become more adventurous with color. Mm-hmm. I think there's always that fear of making art that's too beautiful or too attractive because maybe it will take away from the content. And now I'm using color as part of the content, so I feel like it's important. And I think my earlier works, I was more focused on line and creating depth with these different line weights, and mm-hmm. now it's about color creating depth.
The exhibit at the Volume 1 Gallery is called Of the Earth, painting by Jessica Mojan. What is up at Volume 1? What kinds of things will we see?
I have 17 paintings. I have a series of smaller paintings on paper and then larger ones that are a variety of sizes. Most of them are paintings that I created during my time in Wisconsin, so I guess August on, less than a year so far. I also have a book of my drawing a days that I did in Wisconsin, so you can look through those.
Did you see your paintings change as soon as you moved here?
Well, it took me a while to get going painting here because it was sort of an adjustment to the different landscapes. So first I really just walked around and took photos, and I was doing my drawing a day project. But yeah, it didn't take that long for them to change. I was looking at different things.
Jessica Mojan, lecturer in art, UW Barron County in Rice Lake. The exhibit is up at Volume 1, the gallery in downtown Eau Claire. It's up through June 27th. It's called Of the Earth, painting by none other than Jessica Mojan. Thanks so much for being with us. I urge people to get over to Volume 1 to see your stuff because it's very, very... what word would you like me to use to describe your art?
Exciting.
Okay. Exciting is good. We'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Al.
And for a preview of what you'll see when you visit the local store gallery, go to her website. It's Jessica Mojan, and it's not spelled the way you would think it is. It's M-O-N-G-E-O-N, like Mangian. M-O-N-G-E-O-N, pronounced Mojan.com. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Jennifer Higdon's Blue Cathedral and Mahler's Titan Symphony wrap up the symphony's 40th season Saturday at UW Eau Claire's Gantner Concert Hall. Details at cvsymphony.org. There you go. There's proof of the website, cvsymphony.org.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. Little Women will be presented by the Menominee Theater Guild Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. The Old Gem Theater of New Richmond will present Charlie and the Chocolate Factory weekdays for school audiences through June 5th. There will be performances for the public this Saturday and Sunday. Breaking Up is Hard to Do will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will run through May the 30th. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Cabaret through Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
When the book Shotgun Love Songs was released and after it received awards and international recognition, Nicholas Butler, raised in Eau Claire, perspective was broadened. The writing embers that burned beneath his surface for years were fanned. He since has written the recently released Beneath the Bonfire, a compilation of 10 short stories that, to quote the dust cover, evoke a landscape that will be instantly recognizable to anyone who has traveled the back roads and blue highways of America. Well, I'm curious what happened to Nick Butler since Shotgun Love Songs. How's he changed? What kind of new insights do you have, man?
First of all, thanks for having me on the show. It's
You're
nice to be
welcome.
Here.
Thanks for coming.
What kind of new insights do I have? I've just been on the road pretty much for the last year out there promoting Shotgun Love Songs and meeting with booksellers and librarians and trying to get the good word out on that. And it's been a really wonderful, positive year in my life. I mean, the book did really well and picked up some nice awards and has been performing well overseas.
I was going to ask you about that. Why did the French people love you so much?
I don't know. The honest answer to that is I don't know.
I think it's cool. But
it is cool. And I think as an artist, I mean, it feels like some sort of special validation that a culture that cares so much about the arts is embracing it. But I don't know. When I thought about Shotgun Love Songs, I thought it was this book that maybe only people from Wisconsin would appreciate because it's heavy on Green Bay Packers and bar life and, you know, farming communities. But I think the thing that resonates, that hopefully resonates, you know, universally is that it's about friendship and love and kindness and decency and,
All right. So now you're here because the new book is Beneath the Bonfire.
Yeah.
Stories, it says, in a very small subhead.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a natural progression? Is this something that you felt coming on while you were finishing Shotgun Love Songs? Where did this come? Out of the blue, or was it calculated?
Some of these stories were written before Shotgun Love Songs was even a thought. Most of the stories were written concurrently with Shotgun Love Songs while I was in grad school. A few of them were kind of written, you know, about the time I finished Shotgun Love Songs or even a little after. But I just worked like a crazy person while I was in grad school. And I had this project more or less finished and was working on the novel at that same time. And was really fortunate when we sold the novel that the publisher was interested in taking this as part of the package, too. And it means a lot to me because it's hard to sell a collection of short stories. People don't seem to get as excited as they do with a novel. And so, I'm thrilled to have it out there in the world.
I sometimes think that I should have been a medical examiner because I really like to dissect things. And when I was thinking about, you know, a novel versus a collection of short stories, I thought, you know, I'm going to ask Nick about the process because there's so many things, so many variables that come into it when I think about it. So you are a writer of stories. You had some of these, as you said, already done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then some of them are contemporary. How do you know when you say, I'm going to publish a collection of stories, how do you know what stories are going to go into that? What kind of collection to have and where they sit in the book and that kind of stuff?
I don't know how resonant it is for younger folks now, but for me, it's a little bit like making a mixtape. You're thinking about how stories are going to flow into each other, what kind of emotional note you want to strike with people. And, you know, one conversation that my agent and I had while we were sort of organizing things before the book sold was one of my thoughts was to make this book very dark, real dark, so that it would sort of stand in opposition to the novel, which is very light.
Okay.
Not light like light beer, L-I-T-E, but light in terms of goodness and wholesomeness and stuff like that. And
its title doesn't signify light, Shotgun Love Songs, but keep going.
No, you're right. And conversely, this one does suggest light. But my agent really felt like it was important to spike stories throughout the collection that were more light-filled, that were sort of happier or something like that. And the collection ends with this short story called Apples, which is sort of based on my father-in-law. And it's all about decency and kindness and second chances in life and rebirth. And the way my agent sort of talked about it was that it was a little bit like a palate cleanser at the end of a meal or a dessert or something like that, something to just change up the flavor. So,
or a they lived happily ever after feel.
Or something like that. People like that.
Nicholas Butler with us on Spectrum West. It's called Beneath the Bonfire, 10 short stories all about what? Wisconsin and Minnesota, I hear.
Wisconsin and Minnesota.
As you can tell, I just haven't made it all the way through the book, which is okay, because I was admitting the other day to another author that I'm just not a prolific reader.
I'm not a prolific reader either. So,
well, the only times I have for reading is when I hit the sack, and my body says, I know why we're here.
Yeah.
I'm going to sleep. And so I get about 10 minutes in, and I just haven't been able to make, time for reading during the day.
Yeah. And that's one, actually, that's not to sound like a complete salesman, but that's one of the wonderful things about a short story.
I appreciate this, by the way.
I mean, if you only have that 15 minutes at the end of your day where you're sort of alive and aware and you want to decompress a little, you can read a short story and punch it out rather than, you know, holding a 400-page novel in your hands and just thinking, there's no way, you know, I'm going to get through this.
Well, that leads to my next inquiry, and that is that as an author or as a creative person, you get a story in your head. It comes to you somewhere. You make the note, you put it in your phone, you do something like that.
Yep.
So you say, oh, yeah, man, that's a good idea. I can't wait to write that. How do you and when do you find out, is it during the writing process that you say, you know, this doesn't have legs enough to be more than a short story? This can't be a whole book. Do you know that from the beginning, or does that happen as you're writing, that you say, nah, this is just going to be a shorty?
With Shotgun Love Songs, I never saw it as a novel. I thought that it was going to be a collection of longer short stories or novellas. And I sort of got Jedi mind tricked into writing a novel. Had to trick myself and had to have other people trick me. with this thing, I think I get a story, you know, I hear something from a friend or at a cafe, and I'm pretty aware that it's always just going to be a short story because I don't see a narrative arc that can sustain itself for more than 15 pages or something. And you're trying to just do what's right for the story too. I mean, it's sort of like telling a joke at a bar versus writing a novel. I mean, a joke is just, it's just here. It's just 60 seconds. It's just that little narrative. And it's the same thing with a short story. You just want to kind of give somebody a gut punch or something like that. You're not trying to go 12 rounds with somebody, you know?
Do you think about the people who you are trying to entertain when you write? You know, when you're a musician, you see the audience.
Yeah.
When you're an artist, you hang it up there and you know that people are looking at it.
Yeah.
I think about authors trying to devise an appeal of some kind. There's a lot of different interpretations of things. People can read one page and they'll see it 10 different ways.
Absolutely.
Do you think of all those different kinds of people, or do you think of nothing at all and just write?
In my experience, the harder I have tried to make other people happy, the worse it's gone for me. The best thing is to be true to yourself. You know, it sounds hokey, but the best thing is to be true to yourself, to make yourself happy. And you're absolutely right. You put something out into the world and people are going to see whatever they want to see. And you have no control over that, even as much as you're trying to appease them. So in the end, why would you try and appease them? You know,
in all your wide travels, have you had, I'm guessing you have had somebody come up and had an interpretation of what you wrote you didn't expect?
For the most part, if people don't like my writing, they don't tell me, or they lie to me, you know, they tell me that they love it. But I've had people
it's
come
just
up
like
to
the
me
people
and
on the back of the book here. The people who do the blurbs and the endorsement.
That Michael Perry.
Yeah.
Oh, he's always lying
what
about
is
me.
He, no, he had his fingers crossed when he typed that.
Yeah, no, he's been super supportive and kind to me. And
good.
Hello to Michael Perry.
Doesn't surprise me.
The most recent thing that comes to mind is I've had folks come up to me and have some qualms perhaps with the amount of adult language or cursing in my books or the amount of alcohol use or drug use. And I just – I have to say I'm reporting on reality. Like whether you disagree with that or not, people are always swearing. People are always drinking beer, especially here in Wisconsin. And people are always doing drugs, and that's just part of our culture.
Yeah. So a little bit of an offshoot of that, I'm saying, you know, I asked you about, do you think about people when you write? The people who are going to read it, this is another thing where I go, where did this come from? I perceive an author writing a novel kind of like an adult sitting in a sandbox. He's made this little village, and he's moving the people around, and there's a certain kind of, I put the word power down here. It's power isn't the right word. But does it feel like that you have this, I mean, you're making stuff up as you go, conjuring up all the stuff that these people are going to do, the good things and the bad things, and does it feel kind of like you're sitting in front of a playhouse and you're moving the people around and saying, I'm going to put you up in the bathroom and I'm going to...
What's the word here? I never remember this word when I need it, but I think the answer to that is no. The surprising aspect of writing is that it's the people in the playhouse and the playhouse itself that somehow has the power over me, which sounds like artistic voodoo or something like that. It doesn't seem like that could be real.
Well,
but
I've heard it before.
You know, we're talking about, for the most part, imaginary people here.
Mm-hmm.
And why am I interested in imaginary people? Why am I interested in reporting on their lives? I have no idea. So,
is it fun to do?
Yeah, it is fun to do. I mean, it's my passion. At the same time, it's a pain in the butt. I mean, I have two young kids. I have a wife that I love a lot. I have a beautiful piece of land where I'd rather be gardening or mowing the lawn most of the time or starting a bonfire or something like that. And
oh,
one
he
of the,
got a, he got a right. word from the book. Smart guy.
One of the last things that I want to do on a beautiful summer day is go inside and stare at a computer screen. That's not that much fun, but it's how I make my living, and it's fun when I get into it. So
do you make yourself do that every day?
No.
No?
No. Maybe I need to get to that point in my career at some point. But for now, there's been a lot of travel. I'd rather spend time with my family, quality time with my family, than worry about necessarily, you know, putting away time for writing. And But I haven't quite figured out what my daily routine looks like yet.
you kind of came out of nowhere, and now you're on the big stage. What's the most surprising thing you've found about being, good or bad, about being an award-winning author now and having to travel around and being handled by editors and people who tell you where you have to be the next day and that kind of thing? What's the most surprising thing you've found the profession?
It's a good question. I guess I think the biggest thing is that it makes you become aware of a book as a product in the same way that a car is a product or a tangerine is a product. This is a huge industry. These are big companies. And as a reader, most of my life, I just looked at books as these bits of art, these acts of passion by artists and these wonderful stories. And then once it sort of becomes your living, you realize this is a commodity. Yeah. And that's the sort of ugly side of the business. But it's fascinating as well to learn that it might take as much as 2 years before it hits a bookshelf because they're going through all the corporate rigmarole to make a product successful and to be marketed and packaged right and distributed right, all these things. In the same way that Ford Motor Company doesn't just create a new car and then the car is on the market the next day. It doesn't work that way, you know.
Beneath the Bonfire, 10 Short Stories, Nicholas Butler, the author. He's with us here on Spectrum West. Previously, Shotgun Love Songs. Book titles. I love hearing or thinking about that process. So you have a whole bunch of stories. Who decides that it's going to be called Beneath the Bonfire?
That's a good question and leads to a good story. In my mind, the title for this collection was always supposed to be The Chainsaw Soiree, which is the first story in the book. Uh-huh. And that's how we sold the collection.
Which would have made it darker.
It would have made it darker sounding for sure. Yeah. The thing is, I think the publishing industry in New York City only knows of chainsaws as Hollywood weapons of destruction in horror movies.
Sure, massacres.
And so the notion that, you know, you're going to put out this short story collection with a chainsaw anywhere in the title was totally unpalatable to them. We went through sort of weeks of talks about what else we could name it, and I like Beneath the Bonfire. I mean, I think it's sort of emblematic of what I'm kind of going after and kind of a Northwoods feel and everything, but I was a little disappointed because I felt like Chainsaw Soiree was kind of classically Western Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you live here, you know, you're not going to go after somebody with a chainsaw. I mean, that's crazy.
No, no, not unless you just read a dark book that affected you.
Really dark book.
Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Al. Thanks for having me.
He has a website, nicholasbutler.com. Running a little late, just want to say it was nice to meet lots of you at the Western Wisconsin Listener Dinner Tuesday. Next week, poet Thomas Smith, a young Rice Lake scientist, goes to new heights, and more on Spectrum West. Thanks. See you.